Hey, listeners, this is your host, Abir Sigdur. On this episode of Local Global Leaders, titled Always Side with the Underdog, I spoke with John Kohlinger, the Executive Director of Kentucky Refugee Ministries, or KRM for short. John shares his path to becoming what he calls a reluctant leader, and his journey that's been shaped by years of seeing the world that's empowered him to help immigrant and refugee communities. His story is a testament to how service and dedication can evolve into transformative change. And before we dive into the interview, I want to take a moment to speak as someone who grew up in an immigrant family and as a lawyer. If you've been watching the news and paying attention to what's happening in your community, we've seen federal law enforcement regularly trample on the rights of immigrants and refugees and disregard their humanity, tear families apart, and even lock up children. What's happening is not just a policy issue, it's a moral one, and it contradicts everything that America stands for, a beacon of hope for those seeking freedom and security. Over the last year, I found myself regularly reflecting on the parable of the stranger, a story that comes from a Palestinian refugee and rabbi named Jesus. And in that parable, Jesus reminds us that we will be judged based on the actions we took to support those who are the most marginalized, from the sick to the imprisoned to the stranger, to those who are new to our communities. So as the holiday season approaches, think about how you can be generous and welcoming to newcomers in your communities. I've been really inspired to see amazing supply drives, gift-giving campaigns, so many friends giving food and clothing donations, and so much more to help immigrant and refugee communities and everyone who's oppressed. So reflect on what you can do and think about how you can improve things for the oppressed here in Kentucky and across America. Carry that spirit forward. Now, here's my conversation with John Kohlinger. Greetings, listeners. This is Abir Sigdur on another episode of the Local Global Leaders podcast, and I'm here in the studio today with the head of Kentucky Refugee Ministries, John Kohlinger. John, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Abir, for the invitation.
Really appreciate you being here. Really appreciate the great work you all do at KRM, and so excited to hear about your story. But starting off, just want to ask exactly that, your six-word story. What are six words you want to use to describe yourself to our listeners?
I always side with the underdog. My father used that word, root for the underdog, and I guess in the context of KRM's work with refugees and immigrants, people say helping vulnerable individuals, helping marginalized individuals, but however you want to say it, people who are overcoming struggle, suffered some loss. I'm not sure where it comes from, and I can speak for the tremendous staff we have at our three KRM offices, but you have a lot of those people who come, you don't get sort of jerks who come to show up applying for a job to help refugees and kind of rebuild their lives here. So I'm always interested in that motivation, where they became oriented to helping people who've, suffered, who've been victims. Use the word underdog, but I think it's an important quality in for people to have in our society.
That's cool. I like that theme, that center of underdog. And yeah, I mean, KRM's such a great place with great people. I actually got to intern there in college when I was at the University of Louisville. Just really appreciate that experience and the work you all do. It sounds like, yeah, so would you say, you kind of told us what motivates you to kind of find those people and connect with them. Tell me more about what motivates you to be a leader in your community, particularly the immigrant and refugee community.
Well, I'm a reluctant leader. I didn't set out to, for any advancement. I had had some experiences. I went to college in Chicago area, and had some exposure to immigrants and refugees there. Did some volunteer work with Cambodian refugees and also refugees from Tibet. And then I ended up going abroad. Lived in Amman, Jordan for 3 years in an educational program run by the State Department, and traveled through the Middle East, encountered refugees there and their plight for just kind of protection and recognition of what had happened to them, and you know, had that sort of epiphanal moment. And I haven't had many epiphanies in my life, but you know, I want to help refugees. That kind of was in actually in Cairo, Egypt, and encountered some refugees from Sudan, and who were kind of living underground, didn't have, you know, refugee status. We're trying to get it through the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, kind of harshly treated in Egypt at that time by the police, didn't have work authorization. And I just, you know, was thinking of going back to the United States, and just, I want to work with refugees. And and also referencing my initial experience there in Chicago. And so it's just something, you know, I kind of believe in a lot of things we were taught in school about, you know, America being sort of a beacon of hope and helping oppressed peoples and kind of standing up for human rights and democratic values and rule of law, and kind of in my work abroad and travels abroad, just led me to see there where that was absent and not to take it for granted, and I just feel this country has a lot it can offer to refugees and immigrants who are forced to leave their country, but also that they can – all they contribute to Kentucky, to our country. I really believe in that. So that's – it wasn't being a leader per se. It was just wanting to welcome refugees who had been brought into our communities here in Kentucky.
Yeah, it sounds like you said like that. Being an American and kind of, you know, the privileges we have here, that inspired a lot of that, right?
Yeah, I think people don't take it for granted. I think, you know, I really had some living in Jordan in the Middle East, for example. It was kind of a very immersive cultural experience, very warm hospitality, enjoyed, you know, all around. But I also I traveled to Syria, which you know, and saw sort of, which was a dictatorship, kind of a family dictatorship, and a lot of people could be very easily arrested and imprisoned and tortured and disappeared, I think we some people here kind of refer to it as you read about these things in the news, and kind of why should we be bringing people from these areas of the world where there's violence and strife and conflict and dictatorship. Somehow the victims are kind of tainted by the kind of the stain of calamity in people's minds. Like people coming from, they associate some kind of disturbance to our life here in the United States and how comfortable it is. And but you know, I got to see how people yearn, like the, you know, they just yearn for like safety and opportunity and rule of law and justice and kind of equality of opportunity and welcome, not to be questioned or demonized by their faith or what ethnic group they belong to. And you know, it sounds like I'm reading from a civics textbook, but I believe, you know, in that immigrant story and people kind of coming here and embracing those freedoms and those values and being welcomed in their children, the educational attainment and their success kind of passed on over generations. I just think it's a precious thing for our country. It has been historically.
Yeah, I think that history is important. And it sounds like you said you feel that drive to support the underdog, to support the marginalized, I said, but you also combine that with your civic drive, right? Like with, just being a proud American, these are like important values, right?
Exactly. It's humanitarian, it's driven by like a humanitarian empathy, but in all our staff, we have such empathetic people committed to helping victims and people who've suffered, but also a fervent belief that and this is the joy of working at KRM and working with refugees and immigrants, kind of the transformation along with the struggle, but the progress people make and how, they may have been in a refugee camp, 2 years ago, but now they're working and self-sufficient and their children are acclimated and doing well in school. It's kind of the social adjustment and the pride they have in their, in having become self-sufficient, achieved things and the strength they found here. I think it's helped Kentucky in a lot of respects and the country at large.
And I'll say for me personally, someone from an immigrant family, I'm a proud, born here in America, proud Eastern Kentucky, Bengali American. I like to think, my parents are and my family is good examples of that, of those immigrants who were really helping improve our country and helping the community here. So I really appreciate hearing that. It sounds like, too, from all your experiences all over the world, particularly early in life, like you saw a lot of shared struggles or shared things to overcome across the countries you were visiting or living in.
A mix. I kind of work with a mix of people. I think some well-educated, in Jordan, people really hungry for education and professional advancement, but who felt and also civic engagements kind of felt stymied by sort of kind of political control and even I think we part of KRM's work, and I think it's not something really that the clients, the refugees and immigrants have to navigate is cultural adjustment coming from often like a traditional culture, a culture of a place they call home, and then being they're very attached to that and being forced to flee. And there's a lot of homesickness and longing and nostalgia for returning, home. But they become immersed in life here and work and they meet people and neighbors and friends and they're, and there's, lamenting over their children, not speaking their native language as often or as well as they would wish, or becoming Americanized, and the children are becoming sort of bicultural in their outlook as the parents, and so it's kind of a fluid evolution, and sort of in between states. And sometimes they return home years later if they're able to, if conflict has subsided and realize that they've changed, that they're Bosnian American or Syrian American or Congolese American. Things are different back home than when they left, 15 or 20 years ago. So there's a lot of cultural adjustment and to navigate. And I think in answer to your question directly, we work with it's a humanitarian program, so the people the State Department have been referred to us not on the basis of their professional background, how well they speak English, or their perceived adaptability to life in the United States. It's just the urgency of their humanitarian need, their protection need in their country or their country of asylum. So we have just a wide range of people. Some are, you know, professionals and doctors and engineers, and some are rural folk and differing levels of education. Some have, you know, many have been through traumatic incidents, have lost family members. So it's different types of backgrounds to people.
It's like, yeah, it's a very diverse group of people you work with, for sure, from all over the world and from all different backgrounds. I definitely connect with what you were saying earlier, you know, with that different generational divide of, like, parents seeing, you know, their kids being a new generation, being Americanized. I've seen that growing up with my family, and I still eat too much, like, fast food, for example. My parents aren't fans of that, understandably. But yeah, I really appreciate hearing about all the groups you work with and how you synthesize all that background. What are the biggest struggles you've encountered in your leadership journey, whether in leading KRM or in the work you've done in the past?
I consider myself a reluctant leader. That wasn't my ambition. Just working directly with refugees or behind the scenes in program development. Not particularly public facing, but also KRM, and I became executive director in 2014. I started working there in 2000, so I had good knowledge of the organization, kind of the breadth of services and areas in which we work and partners. But I think everybody who's in that leadership position, it's you have to decide, like, where and how do you get involved. Like, you can't be directly involved in everything you used to be involved in. Are you focused on, you know, public facing external partnerships, on fundraising? You know, there are areas of finance and facilities and human resources and those elements that I hadn't worked in became more prominent, but my roots and my sort of passion was for the things, you know, our staff does, kind of our frontline case management staff, our direct work with the refugees. So kind of finding, you know, how to allocate your efforts, your attention, that's always a work in progress. Also, I've come to see it as there are a lot of things going on in our organization. We have three offices in Louisville and Lexington and Northern Kentucky and Covington. Currently, we have 118 employees at those offices, kind of a breadth of services. People are focused on their own part of the organization, their own work. Somebody has to synthesize and kind of incorporate what everyone's doing into a vision for the organization, and to be able to communicate where we are, you know, what are our strengths, what are our challenges, what's ahead of us, you know, what are we trying to achieve in the coming months, what is our reaffirming purpose that ties all of us together in our different areas. So it's a daily struggle, and it's a great great honor as well. And I think it's almost a cliche, but you talk when I talk to other directors, and it's this question of, often we're required to be reactive to sort of the immediate crisis, you know, the day-to-day thing, but how can you kind of carve out time to kind of focus on sort of constructive, forward-looking things without, you know, just being reactive?
I was like, yeah, kind of your role. What I kind of envisioning when you were saying that you're kind of like the, I don't know, maybe like the blender, like you, all the ideas, you synthesize them into a great product, right? A smoothie or something that everyone can understand, right, for the organization.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of, again, my leadership style is very collective. It's not, you know, focused by any means on my role or myself, and want people to have, you know, responsibility and autonomy and ownership of their areas, and for better or worse, you know, I've never imposed a, you know, kind of layers of hierarchy. It's kind of people have substantial autonomy for their work, and of course they're part of teams, and the teams have leaders, and but it's everybody's voice, everybody's experience has to be acknowledged and kind of factored into kind of the vision for the organization. So that's been also, we've become very, data oriented, and people, kind of metrics are seeping into everything, but it's, there's still the task for, a leader to find out, you know, what's happening, how people are feeling, what are the challenges, what are the successes. So, kind of to stay in touch as opposed to being, you know, kind of remote and getting so that's, you know, people want a personal rapport and, a sense that the director of their organization or the CEO understands what they're personally experiencing in their day-to-day job. So I think that's kind of an ongoing effort to understand the experience of what's going on with the work, the experience of those who are trying to carry it out, and how that all relates and comes together.
I think, yeah, hearing about that style, that philosophy of collective leadership, and yet how you support autonomy and manage all those different things, I think that's a great lead into one of my favorite questions I get to ask our guests. But I have what I call my three M's of leadership: being an effective motivator, a competent manager, and then a supportive mentor. So motivator, manager, and mentor. With those three roles, like, how do you balance those three roles, and do you see them as three separate roles or three things that are all tied together, all those kind of similar things? Or how do you view those three M's?
I do think it's important to, recognize, your strengths and also your weaknesses, and to have people with complementary strengths, around. I think as far as being an effective motivator, I think we're fortunate. The people walking the door wanting to work with refugees and assist immigrants, they already have a strong level of motivation, like a commitment. And I think working as part of a team and our staff with other committed, dedicated individuals, again, helping the underdog. Sorry to use that phrase again. Helping the marginalized person, the victim, the person who's lost everything, who's trying to rebuild. People, our issue is kind of sometimes staff, they can't turn it off. It's not the type of, job where it's, you go to work 9 to 5 and flip the switch and have a beer and the day is done. You're kind of carrying you've heard, people share some struggles and even you're exposed to, people's trauma and the after effects of it. And the deeper, the closer you get, the more need you can see. And then it's, what is the boundary between what our organization, KRM, Kentucky Refugee Ministries, can do and for how many people. I think that's a perennial discussion, but I think our staff understand, refugees, the people we work with, they're survivors. They're it's an overused word, but I think it's an apt one. They're resilience. They've survived so much to get to Kentucky, and they have kind of phenomenal, in many cases, backgrounds and strengths and abilities and also communities that are oriented toward helping other members of their communities. And they have mosques and churches and other, community-based organizations they're part of. So they're independently resilient. They have some community support within their own communities. They get some help from kind of the welcoming people, the volunteers we have in Kentucky here. And then there's us, the staff. So we try to have a recognition of clients' autonomy, and it's not a rescue mission. They ultimately they're going to achieve things if they can on their own. So we're just trying to support them. So motivation is there. Being a competent manager, we've grown quite a bit, and I think a lot of just the scale of our operations. I think any organization that grows, there are some stressors and pains associated with growth. You're not a small group that can interact with people easily. Kind of our departments, be them employment or case management or medical case management, mental health. We offer a lot of educational programs, immigration, legal services, just youth services, and working with from early childhood up to post-secondary college readiness. So we have some departments, some teams, and we're getting big and we're serving a lot of people. So how do we all interact? How do we all share information? Kind of our old structures may not work as well as they used to when we're working at scale. So we have, I'm fortunate to have some leadership staff who have some good ideas on how the organizational structure can evolve to fit what we're doing as an organization. And I think the last of the three components of leadership is my favorite, and I often lament not having the time or not making the time to be, I think being a mentor, a supportive mentor. I think kind of my best days are at the office, or when I kind of reach out to talk to different staff members, or they come in with a problem or something that they want to discuss. We talk about it at length, and I feel I've listened to them and provided some measure of supportive guidance or thought, those are I feel that's the most valuable work part of leadership. So.
Awesome. And I appreciate hearing. I think mentorship, that's one that I've appreciated having good mentors. I think that one might be my favorite too. So I really, really appreciate hearing that. With all the different, like with your work, you know, you hear different voices internally at your work from maybe like how to allocate the money or how to spend money or like what language you all want to use. How do you balance like hearing those different approaches and like, you know, how do you like make a decision around that from just diverse voices you have to hear from with your work?
Well, it's and we do have diverse, you know, voices among our staff, and I can honestly say we have a lot of people that are smarter than me on our staff, and just some really outstanding professional attainments and very committed. So. This may seem counterintuitive, but when I maybe I was just a bit when I took the job, I was new at it. But I again, I had worked at KRM since 2000, 2014, became executive director. I was considerably more prescriptive at that time, starting out. Like I felt like I knew the way that we should do things to some significant degree, and what wouldn't work, and what I found to be effective, and I've just the longer I'm in the job, the more I just want to trust the collective wisdom of the people who are kind of working at our organization every day, kind of working directly with clients. So, I'll just, before there's a decision point, the discussion will, just try to keep the space open and have, everybody's voices heard and people, carrying on the discussion and even having it, and we're not talking about one meeting. I could be talking about something. Usually, it's about how to serve clients, going on or different definition of roles. Go on for a period of of weeks, longer. Just to have that germination process, everybody's heard, and then we implement something. So some people, may find that maddening or inefficient, or too many meetings or too many discussions involving, too many staff members. But that's. It's just a feature of not everything being top down, of not having a lot of hierarchy, of having getting the input from everybody. So, and then on the other hand, there are some decisions that do have to be made. By myself and my leadership, circle, and maybe in consultation with the board, it's a difficult time. Kind of looking forward, broadly speaking, what's referred to as a, for many decades, the refugee program, a public-private partnership, federally funded, a federal State Department humanitarian program, U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Office for Refugee Resettlement, funded, and we were kind of the private implementing local, nonprofit organization, Of course, KRM's always had a large measure of local support, both financial and certainly in terms of volunteer involvement. But it's, you know, we're kind of, I feel like we're going to be heading back to our roots, where we were kind of a small kind of startup organization with just some, you know, some local individuals and faith-based organizations, and we work with, and I'll just note on that, in that regard, we have multiple faiths represented among our staff. We have a very diverse staff. I think the refugees we've resettled over my time there have been, you know, from all over the world, so many different faiths and our kind of external partners. We've been very heartened in Kentucky, and I kind of want your listeners to know that we've been recognized nationally. Like, Kentucky has been the integration of refugees and immigrants, their attainments in terms of employment and continuing education, and we've had a lot of, like, home ownership. It's kind of miraculous, like, you know, refugees who come and start out in entry-level jobs, and, you know, 4 years later they bought a home, and then they become naturalized citizens, you know, 5 years later, and their kids are doing well in school. So there's been a lot of opportunity here that's followed that support. So, but the question, you know, was about you know, decision making, and things are, you know, there are a lot of abrupt changes, probably in the offing that we've already, you know, had to navigate recently. So, but I think there's a lot of flexibility, a lot of different stakeholders, a lot of local support that is going to be sustaining for us.
Yeah, it sounds like I said, hearing from all those shared voices and different diverse voices from different backgrounds, I mean, that, of course, ties in well to your main philosophy you mentioned earlier of collective leadership. And it's great to hear, too, that, like, I mean, the work you do really is helping Kentucky. I think it ties back into what you were saying about not just, like, civic engagement, but being a proud American. Like, the work you do is, of course, helping people who come here from across the world, but also it's, like, helping us here locally, too. And I think, you know, what you're saying there, this ties in well to the next part of the interview. Now I'm going to ask some of my, what I call my kind of global questions and some fun questions, too. But how do you internalize, like, kind of global identity or the idea of global citizenship in your work? And, like, how do you look at what's happening around the world? You mentioned how you saw what's happened around the world in your early life. Like, how do you see what's happening around the world now? How does that affect your work here in Kentucky and with KRM?
Yeah, no, that's a, you know, I'll go back to, it's kind of this example that sticks in my mind. When I was living in Chicago after, you know, graduated from university, I volunteered, I mentioned, with an organization was assisting Cambodian refugees, and my job was as a volunteer to teach a former Buddhist monk who was applying for the to become a naturalized citizen, the citizenship exam, which has some tricky, like, civics questions, and he barely spoke English, so it was very slow going. I ended up spending 2 years with him and his wife, and he had three daughters, kind of living in a kind of low income neighborhood in Chicago, working in a factory. But during that time, I knew, you know, there had been a genocide in Cambodia. A staggering number of people killed, and read a lot of books, and, you know, about Cambodia. And I've always, again, had kind of interest in international affairs and in foreign cultures. So, when I got here, we were settling a lot of Bosnian refugees, and that's been a very successful. The Bosnian American community has contributed a lot to Kentucky throughout the state, very successful. But, you know, kind of immersing myself and reading about the war in Bosnia and in recent years, Kentucky has resettled kind of one of the largest community of Congolese refugees in the country, both Louisville and Lexington. So kind of reading about those conflicts. But again, I understand most people, you know, that's not their – they're focused on their lives, and they're not kind of – the brain's not wired to be following every conflict, you know, across the world. So, you know, or see things in terms of refugee resettlement as redress for injustices committed, you know, throughout the world that haven't been for which, you know, no one was punished, no one was there were just victims, and were at least in receiving and assisting the victims, kind of standing up for the ideals of democracy and rule of law and human rights. But so people come at like global. You know, there's America first versus globalism, globalization. What does that mean to, you know, to people? Does it mean loss of jobs here? And, you know, people have different concepts of it. But I think it's I think a lot of people understand, like, the workforce development benefits immigrants have brought to our states. This is like a personal example. When, like, my father was like in the hospital, and you know, I just noticed when I was there that a majority of the people caring for him were nurses and doctors. They were foreign born. Some of them I recognized as, you know, as former refugees. I think people aren't aware of how integral, even in a, quote, low immigrant state like Kentucky, the role immigrants play in so many sectors of our economy. We're very proud of the presence of immigrant and refugee students. You can see on in our community and four-year colleges across the states. There's also some Republican members of the, you know, the state assembly legislature who recognize that and have supported educational attainments for immigrants in our state, something we need, along with the workforce development, the entrepreneurial activity, this kind of logistics and distribution economy of warehouses and a lot of refugee and immigrant trucking companies and people working in medical care. And it's just – it's very – I don't think people realize how the role immigrants play in our state's development, be it if you'll indulge, like, two more examples, like our largest in Louisville, the company that's employed the most of our clients is GE Appliances. They've hired over 400, you know, refugees and immigrants, have had great experience with their work ethic, their retention. You know, that's one part of it. Adults working entry-level jobs, but I had a Somali client who he's a truck driver, and he had interpreted for us. This is in Louisville. He came in proudly wanting to he had kind of left his job. He was studying to be a pharmacy technician, but he had left his job to support his younger sibling, left his studies to drive a truck and support his younger siblings, both of whom graduated from University of Louisville Medical School. And so he was showing me their reveal, like where they got their residencies, and one is kind of University of Kentucky Hospital and one at University of Louisville. So kind of second-generation medical doctors here, kind of homegrown, I feel, like through the welcome that the family was provided through the refugee program. So I've just seen a lot of strides in like medical providers, how they serve patients who don't speak English, our public school systems. It's hard to be, if you're a city and you want to attract, chambers of commerce talk about talent attraction and kind of being welcoming to immigrants is essential. I know in Northern Kentucky, that's a very prosperous, economically dynamic part of the state, but kind of underrepresented in terms of immigrants. And around Greater Cincinnati Airport, there were a lot of logistics, like warehouses and facilities up there for which they weren't they were struggling to find the workers to keep up with the dynamic growth. They were big champions of us, KRM, opening an office in Covington in Northern Kentucky. And so we've had some very good employment outcomes for clients there, as all three of our offices. So I don't think it's I think there's been a special dynamic. I grew up in Cincinnati, Ohio. I came to KRM to Kentucky for my job like 25 years ago. I have found some authentic warmth and friendliness or hospitality in local culture here and some we have people coming to assist us from kind of a faith-based background, and some more from a civic-minded background, or kind of wanting to help people out of compassion or empathy, or kind of just that American ideal of being welcoming to immigrants who are here to contribute and be part of our communities. So it hasn't been a contradiction, no matter, it's worked well in terms of acceptance, in terms of benefits to the state, the communities where KRM and their other organizations assisting immigrants across the state. So, I think, and I know University of Kentucky, they have a lot of global initiatives just as to achieve some preeminence as an academic institution. You have to be tied into research and initiatives kind of, not just across the country, but across the world. And so I think it's just a mutual benefit and benefit for the state.
And it sounds like, you talked about this, especially with the economic opportunity, the economic empowerment of the work you all do to help immigrants and refugees, that the work you do is really putting like you're kind of putting Kentucky on the global map. You're, you know, really showing the world what Kentucky has to offer, right? And how we can empower the world.
Yeah, I mean, and I don't mean to reduce it. Like, I came to this work from a humanitarian, you know, point of view, and also the ideals I felt it represented of assisting people whose human rights had been inviolated and people like victims of repression. But just the manifold like contributions to our communities, and it's been able to take place in Kentucky because of a welcoming in environments. I think it's special. Like, it's we have a lot of refugees who've, some of them go to, churches, kind of people they've met. Some of them are pastors and start their own churches. We have, different, mosques, in Louisville and elsewhere in the States. There's been tremendous tolerance, a lot of interfaith work that's gone on. We've had, we've had a lot of church-based support. The Jewish community in Louisville and Lexington has been kind of staunchly supportive of refugee resettlement. We have, ties to kind of Muslim American communities. We realized when we started resettling Syrian refugees during the Syrian refugee crisis, 2015-2016, we had a substantial number of Syrian American medical doctors in the Louisville area that were, quite affluent and kind of wanted to help these kind of Syrian, newly arrived Syrian refugees. And there's a lot of there's more diversity, in the state than people are aware of, and I think it's been, we have a good history as a state.
Yes, yeah, that's amazing, being able to use and work with people who are already here in the community and going back to your model of collective leadership. And with that thought of, of course, mentioning diversity, I was curious how, kind of recent responses or even criticisms around diversity and equity and inclusion, DEI initiatives at both the federal and the state, and I guess the local level too, have those affected your work at all at KRM?
They haven't affected our work because it is by definition, we're working with a diverse clientele, and our staff are, comprised of, many former refugees and immigrants. We're very proud. We focus a lot on youth and educational attainments and again the representation of students on so many campuses throughout the states. I think has been very heartening. And again, we're, as a state, educational attainment, we're trying to increase the number of college graduates per capita. We're trying to elevate the states, and I think it's been beneficial to it just enriches the classroom if you have people in the classroom who are bringing different life experiences and perspectives. And we had, I'll mention one, KRM client years ago came through the Lexington office from Democratic Republic of Congo, and it was South Africa is a country of asylum, and went on, and he worked for KRM for years, and then you know, got a master's and PhD in political science, and then, you know, was working his PhD, was back doing as a case manager for us. He's a professor at Eastern Kentucky University in political science. So I think it's the it's just an enriching to have different perspectives represented on campus, different backgrounds, to give that exposure, to give that global, you know, it's not just something you read about. It's not an abstraction. It's kind of, you know, you're discussing it, you're debating it, you're hearing different points of view in the classroom. You know, I'm not sure what the effects will be, you know, on campuses. You know, I'm hopeful, just like on a purely, I'm sure on a merit, you know, basis, they'll, I hope educational access continues to be high for immigrant and refugee students. So, yeah, it hasn't directly affected our organization, but it's it would be something our clients would experience in kind of their, you know, kind of in their lives here.
Okay. What advice would you have to offer to people who hope to become leaders, you know, particularly leaders like you, whether in broadly in the nonprofit work or more so in the international immigration work you do? Like, what advice would you have for someone?
I think, you know, I interview, you know, a fair number of recent graduates, and they are interested in advocacy and policy and, you know, and want systemic change. But I do think people need help. People need, you know, this direct service. Case management, other direct services, being education, or, you know, all specialties, kind of healthcare, mental health. I encourage people to get involved in direct services and social services, to really become close to the kind of vulnerable populations that they ultimately want to serve, you know, through policy or so I think CARM has been an incubator for that to some degree. People come in and they you know, they work for some years in direct services with refugees and immigrants, and then they decide they want to become an immigration attorney. And we've had several people go on and become foreign service officers, like for the State Department, or some people, you know, working in kind of medical case management, with public health backgrounds, get positions kind of, you know, overseas, like helping doing humanitarian work. I think it's I think if you're rooted in the direct experiences and needs of people you're trying to help, I think that grounds policy and advocacy work. So, I mean, I feel our every day our staff, we're advocating for access. You know, it can be hard to access, you know, public services, public benefits, healthcare. I mean, just you know, just for any American, sometimes that's challenging. You know, mental health. We help people find employment. I think it's, you know, sometimes I think our staff, because they're so committed, I mean, they're doing they're really strongly advocating for equal access within our work with children, and our we're working in partnership with Jefferson and Fayette County, public schools, and in schools in Northern Kentucky. We're letting the administrators, working with teachers, letting people know the needs, the service gaps. Like, what are, even we just had back to school. That's quite an undertaking, getting all the bus information and the school assignments. And, our staff are kind of working overtime in partnership with schools, helping, helping everybody, get on the bus and go to their new school and have all the things they need to start school. So it's there's a lot of advocacy you can do in direct services and, understanding how systems impact, what kind of barriers systems can put up for immigrants, and also what kind of policies and things can provide equitable, access for immigrants and refugees.
That's awesome. That's a lot of, a lot of good advice for people who want to do the work. What advice do you have also for leaders, whether individuals or organizations, or even for like movements who want to put Kentucky on the global map and show the world what we have to offer here in Kentucky?
I think it's really a broad-based effort. And I can say this, like organizations like KRM are, we play a primary role in kind of a global, character showing our states, has that connection and integration with what's going on around the world. But it's really, if you work in human resources, if you're a medical provider, if you're a teacher, some people make the effort to welcome and to outreach, and it could just encourage. It's nothing special. It's just being encouraging to immigrant students in your classroom, or patients, kind of taking time to kind of listen to them describe it, like in a medical setting, what their illness is or what their pain is. I think sometimes human resources can be hard to navigate. I'll give you another example. An employer is, I think it's perhaps a Korean-owned company in Elizabethtown that's making batteries for Ford electric vehicles. It's a new facility. It's a high-paying job. They hired some refugees from KRM, and they're asking for more. It's been a good experience. But I think sometimes there are a lot of barriers to people getting in. Maybe it's the screening or the application or the English level, or and I know AI is being incorporated into hiring, and people don't, we don't pick up, when we pick them up at the airports, they don't have a spiffy resume, or they don't have things that people like local employers can understand. Sometimes educational credentials aren't abroad, aren't recognized here. And it's just taking that time to, work with an organization like ours. And we have kind of a large employment staff helping job developer, helping place people in employment. you know, we work kind of like a staffing agency, except, you know, we don't charge anything. It's we're just trying to help secure the financial well-being of these refugee families. And but just, you know, it may take a little more time, but you may have some stellar employees that stay with your company long term and become, you know, in advance, become just, you know, tremendous contributors to your business. But you just, it's a matter of being open, you know, open to it. And so I think that, I don't know, there's no good phrase for it. Like, you know, we call it like cultural competency, or, you know, some people say like cultural sensitivity, but different, just being, you know, while maintaining, you know, equal standards, but being understanding and welcoming to immigrants, I think, you know, can create, you know, if you do that, you'll find, you know, that's you're maintaining a standard that's beneficial for all, you know, for all, and kind of provides opportunities for Kentucky, you know, and for whatever organization you work with that you may not have known, you know, were there. But I think you know, people have said to us, well, this is, I didn't know you guys existed. I didn't know we could hire, you know, refugees. I didn't know you were helping them find jobs. I didn't know they, you know, they were required to work in such a short time and become self-sufficient. I didn't know, you know, you provide, you know, interpreters and different things. There can be some benefits and opportunities for everyone there.
Awesome. It's so great to hear. Like, I mean, you're sharing like the great work your staff does, but also refugee and immigrant leaders here already in the community or who've come here, and also like what, you know, what companies are doing and how they're creating jobs here and like helping, you know, helping improve Kentucky. So that's just really great to hear about all these amazing leaders. For my last question, I want to ask, who are your local and global heroes, like kind of your leadership role models, whether fictional or real role models who you look up to?
You know, it's, I don't know what to say, answer that question. I think we live in a, you know, a very, you know, polarized, you know, society, country. People are very vehement in their beliefs, in their statements, and, it's very tense, and people, you know, opposition, people are, you know, people who don't agree with you, you know, are often demonized or, so I'm old enough, to really mark that as kind of, the stridency of political, you know, debate and discourse, and the stakes are very high. You know, I think we all recognize the stakes are very high, and there's some profound disagreements. So maybe it's nostalgia, but I know kind of over the years, you know, I read a number of books about Gandhi, and I think in you know, and Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement. And I have, and also for me, mention another hero. I know the, kind of within the realm of civil disobedience and peaceful protests, kind of, I remember following kind of the fall of kind of the collapse of the Soviet Union and kind of people power revolutions, like in you know, the Prague Spring and the Velvet Revolution and Vaclav Havel, and but just going back to Gandhi and Martin Luther King, I'm just struck by the eloquence and dignified and respectful manner in which they engaged people that they profoundly disagreed with, and I believe, you know, I've just just my personal relations with people, I do believe like disagreement is oftentimes it can't be avoided, and if you express your views, contrary as they may be, in a respectful, civil manner, you're better able to be heard, and it's not some irreparable rift that's created. So pardon that meditation, but I don't know if that's, you know, that's effective. You know, it's sometimes I try to transplant Gandhi in different, you know, what would happen if Gandhi was in Gaza, or if Gandhi, you know, was a, you know, citizen in Russia right now, you know, what would, you know, could those tactics be, you know, effective? You know, we have a lot of, you know, there's a lot of might makes right in this world, and just a lot of deployment of force, and so yeah, I'm just hopeful there can be some restoration of some dialogue that's not oriented toward total like fragmentation or kind of division, but the stakes are high. So, and certainly in the work we do and who we're advocating for, and legal protections, I think it's in due process. I think these things have served our country well, and so I'm concerned. I'm just we'll see what the future brings, but I think it's I think it's good that you're doing, people are looking for leadership voices, but what type of voice, you know, is it a charismatic voice? Is it a populist voice? Is it a voice of reason? It's a kind of what is the tone of that voice? And of course, what is the content what are the principles and the practical aims of the political movement, the political mobilization that people are trying to organize. So we'll see. So, but that's my own orientation is toward kind of respectful, dignified, but kind of uncompromising, uncompromising principle kind of in political dialogue. So
that's awesome. Well, John, thank you so much for taking the time for this interview. It's been great to hear about your background, the amazing work you've done around the world, and how the work you're doing here at Kentucky Refugee Ministries, it helps not just the global community here, but it really helps everyone in our great Commonwealth. So thank you for your leadership and the great work you do.
Thank you for saying so, Abir, and for the invitation.
That wraps up my conversation with John Kohlinger. His final message of maintaining uncompromising principles and keeping up the fight against political oppression is a key lesson for leaders and for those trying to uplift immigrant and refugee voices and all marginalized communities. You can visit
Kentucky Refugee Ministry's website by going to kyrm.org, where you can also donate to them. My next episode will be released in January, and it will feature Michael Adams, the Secretary of State of Kentucky. Remember to live local and think global, fellow changemakers.